chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, and no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass may have in the middle of it.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got really a fine guest with us this evening, and he's written a book that is, boy, it's devastatingly insightful. That's about the best way that I can describe it. The name of the book is Technocracy Rising, The Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. And it is a blockbuster. It's really a good. Welcome to our program, Patrick Wood.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'll tell you what. Tell our listening audience a little bit of your background, and then tell us what motivated you to write this book.
Well, certainly. I have been writing about globalization and the global elite for almost 40 years. I started in the late 1970s writing with a gentleman that had formerly worked at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. His name was Anthony C. Sutton. And together, we produced two books back in those days called Trilaterals Over Washington. We had volumes one and then volume two, and we wrote extensively about the machinations of the Trilateral Commission and its members during that early period of time. It was formed in 1973, actually, by David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski. Kill a phone call there.
Yeah, okay.
Together, the Trilateral Commission set out to create a new world order. And that was their language. And they were very powerful group of people from North America, from Japan, and from Europe. And very small membership on one hand, but they happened to end up dominating the Carter administration in 1976. That's what alarmed us, that is Sutton and myself, that almost one-third of the membership of the Trilateral Commission was swept into the Carter administration. Jimmy Carter and his running mate, Walter Mondale, were both also members of the Trilateral Commission. And so we knew we had a story, and we started to investigate it and write about it. And so that's how I got my start. Professor Sutton passed away in 2002, and shortly thereafter, I found out that all of his original research had been lost. It was an unfortunate story, and I won't explain it, but it was lost. And so, as it turned out, I was the only one in still living that had a duplicate research, if you will, on everything that we did back in those days. And so I picked up the trail again and began to write about the current developments of this new international economic order. And I ran across the topic of technocracy several years ago and realized very quickly after some research that technocracy was really what the Trilateral Commission intended to do back in 1973 when they talked about their new economic international order. And this was not, we didn't quite know what to do with the word new back then, right? We only understood economics from a traditional point of view, let's put it that way. Sutton was a professor of economics, by the way, and I was not a professor, but I had a degree course in economics, so I had a pretty good understanding of economic system. And we really didn't understand that they had technocracy in view in those days, but today it's unmistakable. And so I had to write this final book. It's sort of, you know, completes the trilogy in a way. But this is the end game of the global elite at this point, is the implementation of technocracy on a global basis, not just regional. But this is a global program to convert the entire world into a new type of an economic system. This is awfully difficult to express, as you probably are going to know. It's hard to get your head around it, what they're trying to do, but we'll tackle it here.
Yeah, you say that there were isms like positivism, scientism, progressivism, Darwinism, and fascism that provided some kind of a foundation that they could use to build this technocracy from, or what? What would your...
Well, you know, there was, back in the 1930s, where the original movement of technocracy was created, it was the heat of the Great Depression. And back in those days, there was a number of progressive ideologies floating around in academia. Things like fascism, things like communism, and, you know, all the isms and so on, scientism. And there was a lot of discussion in coffee shops and stuff over, you know, which was the best for the future of mankind. And the Bolshevik Revolution had come and gone, and Russia was experimenting with communism, and there was a big communist movement in the United States as well. And there was a lot of talk about Darwinianism and, you know, social development, those sorts of things. And out of that cauldron, that stew, if you will, of philosophies, technocracy popped out, and in a very unusual way. It didn't come from the traditional philosophers and political scientists. It came out of the scientific community. Engineers and scientists had got together, mostly originally at Columbia University. They were kind of centered around Columbia and New York City. They got together, and they figured that since technology had come into society, it had changed the nature of society forever. And no wonder that the politicians could not run everything. They were looking at the Great Depression back then. And they figured that the politicians had completely failed society. And therefore, that the scientists and engineers should rise up and propose an economic model that would be run by them. Not fascist dictators, not communist butchers or whatever, but should be run by the scientists and engineers of the world for the good of mankind. And so technocracy was born as a brainchild of these engineers and scientists from the likes of Columbia University, for instance. And this is an unexpected route, if you will, towards global domination. But they really believed that that they and they alone had the scientific ability to engineer society so that it wouldn't, A, it wouldn't destroy itself, and B, it wouldn't use up all the resources in the world. And therefore, everybody would die if all the resources were used up. So it's also interesting there was no big institutional support for technocracy back then, other than a couple of universities like Columbia University, the New School for Social Research in New York had a role. But otherwise, there was no Rockefeller money. There was no Carnegie money. There was no Mellon money. They were just existing basically kind of hand-to-mouth. And it wasn't until 1970 when a relatively young professor of political science at Columbia University wrote a book called Between Two Ages. The subtitle was America's Role in the Technotronic Era. And that book was written by Zbigniew Brzezinski. Clearly, it was that book that caught David Rockefeller's attention. Brzezinski and Rockefeller teamed up, and they began to float the idea of creating a new organization, which later became the Trilateral Commission in 1973. And after they got sufficient encouragement from their globalist buddies, they went ahead and did it. And they drew members from three regions of the world, North America, Japan, and Europe. There was about 190 members initially, all around, of course. There was about 90 plus from America. The rest of them were all foreign to America. And off they ran to create their new international economic order. Brzezinski's book, Between Two Ages, was a book we looked at extensively back in the 1970s. We understood it, we thought, pretty well. But until you understand what technocracy is all about, you'll never understand the true nature of Brzezinski's book. And after I studied technocracy myself several years ago, I went back and I carefully reread Brzezinski's book, Between Two Ages, to see if there were not parallels between what he was writing and what technocracy was had written about in the 1930s. And lo and behold, I found almost tit for tat, the themes and the development, the thinking and so on was the same. It's just that Brzezinski called it his technotronic era, technotronic, instead of technocratic. They're very close linguistically, but they're just far enough off to where the casual observer would not put them together.
Right. Technotronic would be like electronic devices or something versus a system of rule.
That's right.
Technocracy, right? Using high tech or technological advances, right?
It makes use of technology, but what sets technocracy apart from all of these other isms and methods of management of society, like communism, socialism, fascism, and so on, is that technocracy proposed to do away with capitalism altogether. They really believed it was going to die completely and it would never come back to life. Technocracy was to be a replacement economic system. They wrote that back then. It was a replacement economic system based on energy instead of money. And the whole idea was to calculate everything in terms of the energy used and consumed rather than to have money and supply and demand determining what goods will be made and how much you pay for them. So they envisioned a system where the controllers, the engineers and scientists that control the society, they would make the determination as to what would be produced and what people would be able to buy, and in what quantity and at what price. Now, this is absolutely upside down to the traditional laws of supply and demand that history has always understood. But, you say, well, I still don't quite get that. Well, if you look at what's going on in the world today, with all of the talk about surrounding Agenda 21, sustainable development, smart grid, smart growth, focused on energy, all of these things that are being brought to us from the United Nations have their roots within the membership of the Trilateral Commission. That's what one of the things my book documents very carefully. And the head of climate change, for instance, at the United Nations, a lady by the name of Christiana Figueres, earlier this year, she was at a press conference, gave a statement. This happened in Europe, actually. It never hit the U.S. press, but it was in the European press. She made this incredible statement, and I just need to quote this right now just to show you the seriousness of what these people are talking about. She wrote, and I quote, "This is the first time in the history of mankind that we are setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution." Close quote. Now, that's a shocking statement. In the same press conference, she said it slightly differently. She said, This is probably the most difficult task we have ever given ourselves, which is to intentionally transform the economic development model for the first time in human history. Close quote. You see, this is a sea change event that's right before us here. This is why we can't think of technocracy in terms of, well, it's socialism. Oh, no, no, it's communism. No, it looks like fascism to me. Well, it's got some commonality, but, you can see bits and pieces of it. So, yeah, that kind of looks like this or it kind of looks like that. But when you see the whole picture where they're talking about throwing out the only global economic model we've ever had for some brand new utopia-like economic system that's never been tried in the history of the world. And it's being implemented by a bunch of, well, I won't call any names or whatever, but a bunch of people that I strongly disagree with at the United Nations and within the Trilateral Commission. I will say, guys, if you think we should just trust you, that you somehow know better because you've got your PhDs, you know, in whatever, tattooed on your arm, you've got another thing coming. Because just because you think it's going to be a good thing, and just because you think you've got it all figured out, you're risking the entire planet here. This is not just some social experiment where, you know, you get 20 people and you go out and you start a commune in the desert. If you want to do that, go ahead. You know, I got no problem with it. You, when you run out of food, you'll all be back to town for some for some good grub. But, you know, if you're talking about transforming the entire planet according to your utopian dream, you're nuts. Absolutely insane. That's the problem with technocracy today, is that people just, it's there, people don't see the big picture. And that was why I was so pressed to write Technocracy Rising. The subtitle, by the way, is The Trojan Horse of Global Transformation.
Do you see,
that's exactly what the,
yeah, do you see this global transformation heading in a direction of a man-centered worldview like humanism, but far worse and very dark, a dark system in the future? What do you think?
It's very dark. And here's how it's dark. And you mentioned, I don't know if you mentioned transhumanism or not, if I picked that up right, but transhumanism is a Siamese twin of technocracy. We won't point a transhuman necessarily, but they both have as their underpinnings the philosophy of scientism. And scientism basically says that all truth about society, mankind, and the nature of things can only be discovered through science. That's the only way you can understand reality is through science. And that's, of course, not true. Science cannot prove love, for instance.
Right.
So, in fact, science can't prove any of the emotions that man has, nor understand why they work the way they work. They just can't do it. So there's lots of discoverable truth, in fact, outside of science. But that's what they believe. They really believe that that everything could be determined through the scientific method. So I think it's a very dangerous way to build a worldview, personally. But but in any case, the idea behind technocracy is so radical and so earth-changing. That's kind of an odd term to use in this context. Earth-changing. They refer to it as transforming. You'll see this language all over the stuff. I've already mentioned the word six or seven times with what I'm, you know, reading here, like these quotes from Christiana Figueres. They use the word transform. And people look at it and they go, well, I don't understand what that would, what does transform mean? Am I going to look different? It really doesn't hit with any kind of a, you can't get a grip on it. You know, what are they talking about? Well, when you see the big picture of technocracy here, you understand transformation perfectly well. It means it's like taking a piece of fabric, like say a piece of white wool, and you're gonna dye it red. You're gonna transform it to be red. And so what you do is you make a tub of red dye. And you stuff the whole thing down in it and soak it in the red dye. And the red dye goes into the filaments and it soaks in to the very cores, not just a surface coating. It soaks into the actual fabric itself and to the little strands of wool. And it literally transforms it from white to red. There's not a stitch of white left when you're done. That's transforming. You pull it out and it's red. This is what they're trying to do with the whole planet. They're taking a planet that was one thing on the, you know, going in, and it's going to be something completely different coming out.
Do you think that with human nature being what it is, that they're going to be successful in their endeavors here?
Well, here's the thing. You know, this is a hard question to tackle. I see the end of technocracy and transhumanism as a huge train wreck, personally, for a number of reasons. I see it as a huge train wreck waiting to happen. It may not happen for years down the road. But what really bothers me today is what kind of hell are they going to unleash on Earth for the rest of mankind? The process of transforming the world. This is probably of greater concern for me than what their ultimate end is going to be. I do not think they'll be successful in the end. In fact, I will make the statement, I think, that this is really only the second global delusion that the world has ever experienced since the Tower of Babel experience in the Old Testament, which was a global delusion at that time, even though the word global didn't mean very much. The world wasn't very big. But today, this philosophy of technocracy is found in every single corner of our planet, thanks to the United Nations. It's everywhere. Everybody, every country on Earth is implementing sustainable development today, including the United States. They're all into energy transformation. Smart grid has gone everywhere. That's the little smart meters on the side of homes and businesses that transmit data back to a central authority. We see all of the talk of sustainable development, and by the way, that's an economic term. Development, that's an economic word. It's not a political word at all. It's an economic word, which supports my point that this is about technocracy. It's not about socialism, which is a political word, or communism or fascism, which is still, those are political words. This is an economic system. And the Trilateral Commission has taken the United Nations as their means of spreading it to all the world. And they have done this very effectively, very efficiently.
Do you see that Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I don't think it's going to turn out well.
Do you see that Brzezinski's, foreign affairs and his strategies and so forth have moved us towards a very dangerous state of affairs with both China and Russia? What do you think?
Well, the political system of the world, just as we look at it today, and I still watch the economic model in the world very carefully for all kinds of reasons, including just to measure up technocracy. The world is on the verge of coming unglued right this second as we speak.
Yes, it is. Yes.
You will recognize that, and your some of your listeners will recognize that, I think, as well, if they've been watching.
It's the most dangerous period that we've been in for a long time.
It is. And we have in front of us the prospects of a humongous deflationary depression, the likes of which the world has never seen, even with the even given the Great Depression from the 1930s. But you see, that economic depression, deflationary depression that's in front of us, where mountains of debt will be destroyed because, you know, people, companies, and countries are going to go bankrupt and renege on their debts, and it's going to have a huge destabilizing effect on the world. But here's what scares me about this. Given what Christiana Figueres said, that I just quoted to you, that their intent is to do away with capitalism, is there not a moral hazard within the global elite that they have created themselves to perhaps do things to help capitalism on, you know, along the way to the grave? This is a very dangerous question to ask, because if they really intend to kill capitalism, then at some point they're going to do everything they can to push it into the ocean and drown it for good. And well, if that's what's ahead of us, if this is the kind of the idea of the global stage right now, that capitalism is about to take a hit that will change the attitude of people all around the world, that we've got to get rid of this evil, evil, ugly, broken system of capitalism, and we need to do something else. We don't know what, but we need to do something else. That'll be just when people like Christiana Figueres sweep in, you see, because they've already got a plan together.
Well, was not the Fabian Society a gradual change in the UK to socialism?
It was, but you see, all of those systems were based on money, on currency.
Right.
They were all based on supply and demand. The only contention was, who was going to manage the society? Who was going to manage the economy? You see, what we had in America, truly the free enterprise system is, just leave it alone, it'll manage itself. The communists came along and said, no, we're going to manage it from a central location. The socialists came along with a slightly different twist. They said, no, we're going to manage it this way, by committee. The fascists came along and they said, we're going to let the corporations management and manage everything in cahoots with the state. But you see, that didn't redefine the economic system underlying all those political systems. It merely said, who's going to manage it?
But what I see, what I see is that we haven't really had an honest capitalistic system, though. See, we've had crony, or you know what I mean, Babylonian, or whatever.
That's
capitalism.
Right.
We haven't really experienced truly an honest system of capitalism where people could really prosper. See, you know, and they have on the lower levels. Yeah, you know what I mean.
That's right. That's right.
You know,
if you look back over the thousands of years, however. The same economic system that we have today, and forget the corporations for just a minute, just what people do on the street.
Sure.
This is the economic system that we've always had since the beginning of the world. There was bartering, and sometimes, you know, the Indians had beads and sticks and wampum and whatever that they used for currency, but the intent is always the same. People make things and they sell it to other people. And that's the basis of economics on planet Earth. And these people basically you come along to the Industrial Revolution, things got really dicey at that point because you had the big robber barons and the big, the big magnates and stuff that ended up getting monopolies on using capitalism to get monopolies in certain industries. And it really turned ugly. After that, and it has been ugly, but still, it's always been some derivative of what the world has known forever. And these people today are saying, no, that's all gone. We're going to get rid of that. We're not going to do that anymore. We're going to micromanage, control the world. We're going to control society from a scientific method. And we will decide what people can and cannot do, what they can and cannot eat, what they will and won't consume. We will make products available that will make their lives happy, quote unquote.
Yeah, and, like drugs, right? Drugs, right?
you can ride your bicycle to work. You can take light rail wherever you need to go. You can sell your car. You won't be needing that.
That's a good point. I was over in Copenhagen at that Bilderberg meeting last year, and there's 25% of the people that were riding bicycles.
Mm-hmm.
At least, you know, they didn't have cars over there.
This is the whole essence of Agenda 21,
which
to the United Nations is the agenda for the 21st century. This is what's playing out today.
Well, let me ask you a second here. There's an example of this Peter Thiel. You know who he is?
Yeah, I do.
And he's founded Palantir, and if you look at that name, that is the seeing stones that are represented in the Lord of the Rings movie and, you know what I mean, novels or whatever. So he, is this a, an example of someone at the highest level that's taking technology and becoming a technocratic, dominant, very powerful person?
Well, it could be. I wouldn't say that's it exactly, but it certainly could be.
Well, he sits on the steering committee of the Bilderberg Group.
Yeah, indeed.
See, so that's pretty. That's a pretty powerful position there. And then he has access to the Palantir, the big data mining of all this intelligence and social networks to provide to his top level elitist friends, using the and then that big data, they've got a foundation there, Leventhal Foundation in Great Britain, that's funded a research group into the tune of over $40 million for big data alone.
Yeah, yeah.
So this thing is getting powerful, you know?
It is. Surveillance and data are key to implementing technocracy. It could not be implemented without it.
Yes, good. Good point.
And the reason I say that is this. You got to jump inside an engineer's mind for just a minute. If an engineer created a factory, if he built a factory to build something, the factory floor has, you know, stations where different pieces of work are being done, has people running back and forth, bringing parts to the assembly line, and, you know, hustle and bustle, stuff going on, and inputs come in from the back of the room through the, you know, and products come out the other side and get loaded on a truck. Well, that factory floor is engineered to work together. And what an engineer will do, knee-jerk reaction, is that he will build in a monitoring system so he can tell exactly what's going on that shop floor every minute of the day. If there's if something breaks down, if all of a sudden they're out of a key part or whatever, they need to sense that immediately in their mind in order to go make corrections and mid-course changes, whatever, and do things to keep the factory floor running correctly. This is called it's just monitoring. Every factory in America has a monitoring system inside of it to make sure that nothing goes wrong, and if something does go wrong, that they know about it immediately so they can fix it. Well, these scientists and engineers have used the same thinking on all of society. They want to engineer society like a big old factory floor. And therefore, they have to have a monitoring system so they know what everybody is doing every second of the day. This is what big data and surveillance, the total surveillance society, is all about. It's not about just being nosy. They want this for a master control system to monitor the entire planet. This is part of their social engineering project. It's a big concept to get your head around.
Right. It's scientific dictatorship here we're talking, right?
You're exactly right. And, you know, there was a book written in 1932 when technocracy was at its height at Columbia University in New York City. The book was written by Aldous Huxley. People not joke, but they use the title of his book today in all kinds of situations to describe things that are kind of scary. And that book was called Brave New World.
I read that, yeah.
Now,
late 50s, yeah.
You know, what nobody told you in high school or college or whatever you read the book first time.
Yeah.
What nobody told you is that Huxley was looking straight into the face of technocracy when he wrote that book. So was George Orwell when he wrote 1984. Now, people that read those books scares the pants off of them by and large, but they don't really understand what they're dealing with. In both cases, it was dealing with technocracy. And Orwell's vision of technocracy was scientific dictatorship. That's exactly what the book is about, scientific dictatorship. You'll do what they tell you to do every minute of the day. They'll tell you when you can eat, when you can sleep, when you can have sex, if you're going to have sex, if you're going to be sterilized, they'll tell you where to work. You may be smart, dumb, you know, whatever you're prepared for, that's going to be your job. You can't dispute it, argue it. There's nobody to appeal to if you don't like something. They'll tell you what to wear, where to go, where to live, etc. It's a scientific dictatorship. That's exactly what technocracy is all about, leading us towards a scientific dictatorship that will not necessarily be run by a man or a woman, a single person, in other words, but a dictatorship that is imposed by technology. This is, the world's never seen this before, you see. A software-driven dictatorship.
Well, that's really cold, isn't it? I mean, it's like computer code and machines and robots that make decisions, right?
It's ice cold.
Yes.
It really is.
It's terrible. To buoyant their view and their change that they want to do through this transformation, they have to try to knock down the existing religious systems. Is that one of the things? I discovered in Changing Images of Man, it was a paper put out by the Stanford Research Institute, that this is exactly, they want to change like the New Age movement and other movements. What's your take on that?
Well, it's interesting that the major church groups throughout the world, the Catholic Church, and I'm just talking about the Christian side of things first, but the Catholic Church, Presbyterians, Episcopalian, Church of Christ, Church of God, so on, the biggies. And then you throw in some of the other interfaith churches that are working with the Christian religions, and that includes even some of the Muslim community, some of the Hindu community, some of the Buddhist community, and so on. You have a website now that pops up. It's been around for a while, but it's called greenfaith.org.
Green what?
Green Faith. Green Faith. F-A-I-T-H.
Green Faith, huh? Okay.
Yeah, Green Faith.
F-A-I-T. Okay. .org. Okay, Green Faith. Okay.
That's right. Now, to parrot Richard Nixon, let me say this about that.
Okay, yeah. Hey, say something about that, will you? You're doing great, Pat. Keep it going. Keep it rolling, man.
Okay, last year in 2014, there was a big conference called the Interfaith Summit on Climate Change. And your listeners are still going to want to go to greenfaith.org and check it out. It'll pop their eyeballs out of their head. But when the conference was over, the Interfaith Summit on Climate Change was over in 2014, the World Council of Churches issued a press release. And this is partly what they said, and I quote, "There has never been such a large amount of religious environmental activity in one location in the history of the world. This week will mark a watershed in the history of religion. It will be the time that people remember as the time when the world's faiths declared themselves irrevocably as green faiths." Close quote. Now, here you have the transformation of religion, you see.
Well, worship Gaia, then worship of the earth, right?
That's exactly right. And even, I think, just a month ago, the Pope.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
An encyclical on climate change.
Exactly.
And he's directing the Catholic Church to be one of the biggest supporters of the United Nations and climate change, and hence technocracy. And so his encyclical went out all around the world, went to all the bishops in the world, who then take it out to all the parishioners they have underneath their whatever structure. And so they've joined the bandwagon to be completely in line with everything we're talking about here, the whole enchilada. So on one hand, you got to ask the question. You know, you ask about, well, what about transforming religion? Well, you could argue from a Christian point of view, a biblical point of view, you could argue that, well, these religions were already kind of apostate. They weren't really Bible-believing, you know, religions per se. You could argue that. But the fact is, the whole lot of them have run off together hand in hand, skipping in the grass, if you will.
Exactly, with a little, you know, flowers in their hair, right?
With flowers in their hair. To follow
it's so much fun, isn't it, Pat?
Oh, my gosh. I know. And,
yeah.
You know, the smaller element of the church, the more like the, you know, the true fundamental evangelical church, they're still scratching their head a little bit, but a lot of them are defecting little by, you know, as we go along, they're defecting into this camp of embracing sustainable development and the so-called green faith that we need to, you know, we need to protect our world. It's a very disturbing trend, let me put it that way. It really is, because this is absolutely non-biblical, extra-biblical, and you have to be on a far, far stretch, really, to get any of this kind of stuff out of the Bible as it has existed historically.
Exactly. In your Appendix 1 here, you get into communitarianism, right?
I do.
Now, they're doing an end run, like it's called the Third Way, as I understand it, and they're trying to reconcile capitalism with communism or something like that?
Well, yeah, communitarianism was, the greatest evangelist that existed in the last century for communitarianism was a business management consultant by the name of Peter Drucker. Was a genius in many ways, truly was, and he definitely had a huge impact on how corporations are run. And he was an evangelist for communitarianism. He was not a Christian, by the way. He said that very pointedly in interviews that he was not a Christian. However, he teamed up with the Christian world, the evangelical Christian world, back in the mid 80s. And he brought this philosophy of communitarianism into the Christian church, into the evangelical Christian church. And his idea was that society rests on three pillars. You have the economic, the political, and then the social sector. And he believed that the social sector needed to come into line with his, with, you know, that, in other words, a third leg on a stool. He viewed the evangelical church as being that third leg. And so he was pleased to bring communitarianism as a philosophy into the church. And they set about together to train megapastors on how to build megachurches that would be transforming of society. I use that word transforming on purpose again. That's what they use. That's what they say. And so, you know, some of the early disciples of Drucker and the Leadership Institute went out and created churches. We now see many of these churches, in a very high profile, like Saddleback Church, for instance, my brain just went skip.
They have thousands of, you know what I mean, members.
It does. It has thousands of members. And Rick Warren is the pastor there, is not only on the Council of Foreign Relations, but he is a global speaker on unifying the world's faith. And he was one of the early disciples of Peter Drucker. What has happened, in any case, what communitarianism produces is community organizers.
Right,
that's
right. Exactly. Well, the community has priority over the individual's rights, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And so what happened is that many pastors who really trained to be pastors, that is concerned with the sheep in their, you know, in their church, they were converted into community organizers. And they still call themselves pastors. Sometimes they call them executive pastor or the lead pastor now, or crazy names. But they would have been pastors, but they really end up being community organizers. And so now the goal of these churches is to heal their local communities, you know, to bring the local community together, to serve the local communities, to transform the local community. And it's kind of a sad thing to say today, but some of these pastors have the same bio now as somebody like the president of our country currently, which was nothing more than a community organizer before he was elected to the Senate some years ago.
Right.
And of course, I'm talking about Barack Obama, the consummate community organizer. Many of these pastors are no better than what, you know, what we see in Barack Obama. They're organizing communities. That's all they're doing. So this departs from the historic mission of the church, the biblical mission of the church, in any case. So Christianity is looking pretty dim right now. You know, it's not that there's still not some churches out there that truly do stick to the Bible and just kind of reject all this stuff. But it wasn't necessary to destroy the Bible totally. It wasn't necessary to destroy all symbols of the cross, for instance, although they're trying hard. But what they've done is they have compromised the lives of people with these crazy philosophies, whether it be the Green Faith Movement or whether it be the community organizing movement. They've taken a swath out of the church that has just left the church basically impotent for any good work. It's sad.
It's almost like they're built these big cults, you know what I mean? Religious cults and things. What's that?
In a way they are, and it's
this church is against that other big mega church because they're wrong on some theology or dogma points. See what I mean? And then they can herd their membership around and tell them we're the ones that are right and the other ones are wrong. See?
Well, that's right. And you know that the technocrats, I've become convinced over time now that the technocrats don't care what you say about anybody else. As long as you're fighting with somebody, you'll never see who they are.
Exactly. Exactly. They've got everybody divided and that's true. So,
keep the division.
Now these community organizers, they have to rely on the emotions of the average person to resent and hate some of these other people out there to get some kind of a hold on them, don't they? Do they not?
Well, that happens. I think that happens.
I mean, they rile them up with hatred and stuff.
Yeah.
And then they can direct them their efforts towards some enemy that's not treating us right, right?
If it's necessary, you see that happening all around.
And I think it's happening on a national basis right now.
Well, it is. If you just take, you can see how our lead community organizer, our president, has divided our country into a thousand schisms. We're divided more racially now than we've ever been in 200 years. We're divided politically more now than we've ever been in 200 years. I mean, there's not one thing today, one area you can go into where there's not division and contention and arguments.
Right.
And I don't think that just happened by chance. Honestly, I think it was part of the strategy. Because as long as people are fighting amongst themselves, they will never see the dirty, stinking rats at the top of the system who are pulling all the strings. That's what I get passionate about. When I wrote Technocracy Rising, you know, I'm not the young guy anymore, right? So I'm looking down the end of the line, not at the beginning.
Right.
When I wrote Technocracy Rising, I said to myself, I'm not holding back on these people anymore. I am naming names. I'm going to call them out and name names and take pictures, if you will.
Right. That's good, Pat. I respect you for that.
These people are guilty of sin, and they stand naked before the evidence. Somebody needs to tell them that. Maybe they don't know they stand naked before the evidence, but they do.
Now the public at large through the internet, are they waking up fast enough, or are they still encumbered by the human nature of frailties and weaknesses?
I'm kind of sad to say that the internet has done more to divide people's intelligent response to anything to where they can't understand anything. You know, there's so much ignorance floating around on the internet that, you know, people get drawn off into crazy ideas and crazy discussions and arguments that have no basis in truth whatsoever. Nobody wants to go after the facts anymore. That's the problem, George.
You're right, because I see that on Facebook, where people are arguing, but it's all emotional stuff and name-calling and ad hominem attacks. See?
It is.
Yeah,
I know. It's just we need to have some facts on the table.
And now what you said earlier, though, Pat, about delusion was very important about the Tower of Babel or whatever, and this new one now is this maybe underway. But I see it on a personal basis that delusion, in my definition, on a personal, interpersonal type of definition, would be that we don't have totally the information that we need to make good decisions. It's not accurate information. But that goes right along with what you're saying about the internet creating a lot of chaos and so forth, you think.
Well, it does. And people need to start, they need to get a hold of some facts, that they need to start thinking for themselves and not just.
Do you think, though, our education system set them up not to be able to think as well for themselves as they used to?
That's true.
See?
That's also deliberate, by the way.
Yeah, and then fluoride and all this dumbing down. And then Charlotte Israby said the deliberate dumbing down of America. No one said it better than that.
No, you're right.
See? So we've been scientifically herded around, conditioned, educated into a state of ignorance, see? So we're susceptible to all this scientific dictatorship stuff.
That's right.
It's what sort of, so, unfortunately, you know, it's not good what the public is thinking out there that I see.
No, it isn't, because, you know, I've been active over almost 40 years now in one kind of political thing or another. I've had friends who virtually expended their life and their fortune defending what they thought was their country, you know, fighting against communism,
right,
or whatever. And all these years, you know, you look back at all the effort that went in to making things right, and you look at the world today and you say, okay, how successful have we been? Well, the fact of the matter is we're worse off today than we've ever been in history. So obviously whatever we've done the last 40 years didn't work very well, did it?
No.
It's just this is a very depressing conclusion.
What I seem to
Our ladder has been leaning up against the wrong wall. All these years we've been fighting all these other things when we should have been fighting technocracy.
Right. Good point. Now Solzhenitsyn said something I thought that was interesting, okay? And basically he said the battle line between good and evil runs through every human heart.
Oh, yes, it does.
You see, so the conclusions that I'm finally reaching at I'm 71 myself, okay? And I'm beginning to say, to look at that struggle within me and concentrate on myself. See what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, not that we don't do talk live like Saturday evening, and try to make a difference to everyone else. But there's that battle that we have to overcome within ourselves.
We do. And the future that Americans want is a far cry from what they're about to get.
Yes. Unfortunately, I can agree with you. We have about five minutes left now. Is there anything that you'd like that we've left out or I did not bring up that you think is important to bring in? And give us your website and things like that.
Oh, please. Yeah. My book website is technocracyrising.com. Just like it sounds.
We have that on the site now. We have that up already.
Great.
But it's good for our listening audience. Yeah. And
they can buy the book.
And what other important points or a few cogent points would you like to make this last 3-4 minutes?
Well, I would say this, that we will never win against an enemy that we do not know. That sounds kind of stupid and trite, but you can't defeat an enemy you don't understand or that you have not identified. And the most important thing that Americans can do today, if they want to do anything at all, is to find out learn who the enemy really is that we need to be engaged with. Then we might have a chance. In World War II, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, every red-blooded American, that was 16 years or older, went down to try and enlist in the military to go fight the enemy. They understood who the enemy was. We're fighting an enemy that nobody knows who it is. So we can't win. And unfortunately, I wish more people would write about this. I'm having, I try hard to get other people engaged, but I just say, until people actually read Technocracy Rising cover to cover, they're not going to get it. And just listening to an interview like this is not going to do it for them. Somebody may think, oh, I'm an expert on technocracy now. I know everything I need to know. No, you don't. You don't. We're barely scratching the surface here.
Right.
You need to get the whole picture and really understand how these people have done it to us, and then make up your own mind whether you're going to be engaged at all. You can do whatever you want, too. If somebody may listen to this and say, I'm just going to throw up my hands. I'm going to forget it. I'm not going to do a stinking thing about it. I'm just going to live my life out with the money I have, be fat, dumb, and happy, and whatever, and play golf. And if that's your choice, fine. You go do that. But at least you're going to make a choice. I believe Americans have the right to face their accusers, if you will. To face their executioner.
Well, I think the work you did with Anthony Sutton was on the divine side. Because he's one of my heroes, and you're one of my new heroes, Pat. Okay? Because I didn't know you were that involved until I started looking at your bio and everything with Sutton. But Sutton was right there on top of it, and you were too.
He was.
I mean, you really saw to the heart of the beast, so to speak.
Indeed. And, if people had listened to us back in the 70s, we wouldn't be where we are today.
Exactly. The people are asleep. It. They're dumbed down, I mean, it's hard to reach them, They're delusional. They've been deluded, with my definition, in that case would be they've been tricked. To delude someone is to trick someone. And they've been tricked thinking the wrong things.
That's right. It's like a magician pulling a trick.
It's like sorcery, mind sorcery. You know what I mean?
Yes, it is. You're absolutely right.
These people are great magicians, or they practice magic on it. But anyway, I want to thank you very much for being with us this evening. And you really made some very, very insightful, points here. And I can't recommend your book. I highly recommend Technocracy Rising. But thank you very much, Patrick Wood, Pat Wood, for being with us this evening.